The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath by H.P. Lovecraft. Part 2. In the morning, Carter joined a caravan of merchants bound for Dailath Lean with the spun wool of Ulthar and the cabbages of Ulthar's busy farms. And for 6 days they rode with tinkling bells on the smooth road beside the sky, stopping some nights at the ends of little quaint fishing towns, and on other nights camping under the stars while snatches of boatmen's songs came from the placid river. The country was very beautiful, with green hedges and groves, and picturesque peaked cottages and octagonal windmills. On the 7th day, a blur of smoke rose on the horizon ahead, and then the tall black towers of Dailath Lean, which is built mostly of basalt. Dailath Lean, with its thin angular towers, looks in the distance like a bit of the giant's causeway, and its streets are dark and uninviting. There are many dismal sea taverns near the myriad wharves, and all the town is thronged with the strange seamen of every land on earth, and of a few which are said to be not on earth. Carter questioned the oddly robed men of that city about the peak of Ngranek on the Isle of Oriab, and found that they knew of it well. Ships came from Baharna on that island, one being due to return thither in only a month, and Ngranek is but 2 days' zebra ride from that port. But few had seen the stone face of the god, because it is on a very difficult side of Ngranek, which overlooks only sheer crags and a valley of sinister lava. Once the gods were angered with men on that side, and spoke of the matter to the other gods. It was hard to get this information from the traders and sailors in Dailath Lean's sea taverns, because they mostly preferred to whisper of the black galleys. One of them was due in a week with rubies from its unknown shore, and the townsfolk dreaded to see it dock. The mouths of the men who came from it to trade were too wide, and the way their turbans were humped up in two points above their foreheads was in especially bad taste. And their shoes were the shortest and queerest ever seen in the Six Kingdoms. But worst of all was the matter of the unseen rowers. Those three banks of oars moved too briskly and accurately and vigorously to be comfortable, and it was not right for a ship to stay in port for weeks while the merchants traded, yet to give no glimpse of its crew. It was not fair to the tavern keepers of Dailath Lean, or to the grocers and butchers either, for not a scrap of provisions was ever sent aboard. The merchants took only gold and stout black slaves from Parg over across the river. That was all they ever took, those unpleasantly featured merchants and their unseen rowers. Never anything from the butchers and grocers, but only gold and the fat black men of Parg, whom they bought by the pound. And the odors from those galleys which the south wind blew in from the wharves are not to be described. Only by constantly smoking strong thagweed could even the hardiest denizen of the old sea taverns bear them. Dailath Lean would never have tolerated the black galleys had such rubies been obtainable elsewhere. But no mine in all Earth's dreamland was known to produce their like. Of these things, Dailath Lean's cosmopolitan folk chiefly gossiped, whilst Carter waited patiently for the ship from Baharna, which might bear him to the isle whereon Carven Ngranek towers lofty and barren. Meanwhile, he did not fail to seek through the haunts of far travellers for any tales they might have concerning Karas in the cold waste, or a marvelous city of marble walls and silver fountains seen below terraces in the sunset. Of these things, however, he learned nothing, though he once thought that a certain old slant-eyed merchant looked queerly intelligent when the cold waste was spoken of. This man was reputed to trade with the horrible stone villages on the icy desert plateau of Leng, which no healthy folk visit, and whose evil fires are seen at night from afar. He was even rumored to have dealt with that high priest not to be described, which wears a yellow silken mask over its face, and dwells all alone in a prehistoric stone monastery. That such a person might well have had nibbling traffic with such beings as may conceivably dwell in the cold waste was not to be doubted. But Carter soon found that it was no use questioning him. Then the black galley slipped into the harbor past the basalt whale and the tall lighthouse, silent and alien, and with a strange stench that the south wind drove into the town. Uneasiness rustled through the taverns along that waterfront, and after a while the dark, wide-mouthed merchants with the humped turbans and short feet clumped stealthily ashore to seek the bazaars of the jewelers. Carter observed them closely, and disliked them more the longer he looked at them. Then he saw them drive the stout black men of Parg up the gangplank, grunting and sweating, into that singular galley, and wondered in what lands, or if in any lands at all, those fat, pathetic creatures might be destined to serve. And on the third evening of that galley's stay, one of the uncomfortable merchants spoke to him, smirking sinfully, and hinting of what he had heard in the taverns of Carter's quest. He appeared to have knowledge too secret for public telling, and although the sound of his voice was unbearably hateful, Carter felt that the lore of so far a traveler must not be overlooked. He bade him, therefore, be his guest in locked chambers above, and drew out the last of the Zug's moon wine to loosen his tongue. The strange merchant drank heavily, but smirked, unchanged by the draught. Then he drew forth a curious bottle with wine of his own, and Carter saw that the bottle was a single hollowed ruby, grotesquely carved in patterns too fabulous to be comprehended. He offered his wine to his host, and, though Carter took only the least sip, he felt the dizziness of space and the fever of unimagined jungles. All the while, the guest had been smiling more and more broadly, and as Carter slipped into blankness, the last thing he saw was that dark, odious face convulsed with evil laughter, and something quite unspeakable, where one of the two frontal puffs of that orange turban had become disarranged with the shakings of that epileptic mirth. Carter next had consciousness amidst horrible odors beneath a tent-like awning on the deck of a ship, with the marvelous coasts of the southern sea flying by in unnatural swiftness. He was not chained, but three of the dark sardonic merchants stood grinning nearby, and the sight of those humps in their turbans made him almost as faint as did the stench that filtered up through the sinister hatches. He saw slip past him the glorious lands and cities of which a fellow dreamer of earth, a lighthouse keeper in ancient Kingsport, had often discoursed in the old days, and recognized the templed terraces of Zak, abode of forgotten dreams, the spires of infamous Thalarion, that daemon city of a thousand wonders where the Eidolon Lathi reigns, the charnel gardens of Zura, land of pleasures unattained. And the twin headlands of crystal meeting above in a resplendent arch, which guard the harbor of Sona Nile, blessed land of fancy. Past all these gorgeous lands, the malodorous ship flew unwholesomely, urged by the abnormal strokes of those unseen rowers below. And before the day was done, Carter saw that the steersman could have no other goal than the basalt pillars of the west, beyond which, simple folk say, splendid Cathuria lies, but which wise dreamers well know are the gates of a monstrous cataract, wherein the oceans of Earth's dreamland drop wholly to abysmal nothingness, and shoot through the empty spaces toward other worlds and other stars and the awful voids outside the ordered universe, where the daemon Sultan Azathoth gnaws hungrily in chaos amid pounding and piping and the hellish dancing of the other gods, blind, voiceless, tenebrous, and mindless, with their soul and messenger, Nyarlathotep. Meanwhile, the three sardonic merchants would give no word of their intent, although Carter well knew that they must be leagued with those who wished to hold him from his quest. It is understood in the land of dream that the other gods have many agents moving among men, and all these agents, whether wholly human or slightly less than human, are eager to work the will of those blind and mindless things in return for the favor of their hideous soul and messenger, the crawling chaos, Nyarlathotep. So Carter inferred that the merchants of the humped turbans, hearing of his daring search for the great ones in their castle of Kadath, had decided to take him away and deliver him to Nyarlathotep for whatever nameless bounty might be offered for such a prize. What might be the land of those merchants in our known universe, or in the eldritch spaces outside, Carter could not guess. Nor could he imagine at what hellish trysting place they would meet the crawling chaos to give him up and claim their reward. He knew, however, that no beings as nearly human as these would dare approach the ultimate knighted throne of the daemon Azathoth in the formless central void. At the set of sun, the merchants licked their excessively wide lips and glared hungrily, and one of them went below and returned from some hidden and offensive cabin with a pot and a basket of plates. Then they squatted close together beneath the awning and ate the smoking meat that was passed around. But when they gave Carter a portion, he found something very terrible in the size and shape of it, so that he turned even paler than before, and cast that portion into the sea when no eye was upon him. And again he thought of those unseen rowers beneath, and of the suspicious nourishment from which their far too mechanical strength was derived. It was dark when the galley passed betwixt the basalt pillars of the west, and the sound of the ultimate cataract swelled portentous from ahead. And the spray of that cataract rose to obscure the stars, and the deck grew damp, and the vessel reeled in the surging current of the brink. Then, with a queer whistle and plunge, the leap was taken, and Carter felt the terrors of nightmare as Earth fell away and the great boat shot silent and comet-like into planetary space. Never before had he known what shapeless black things lurk and caper and flounder all through the aether, leering and grinning at such voyagers as may pass, and sometimes feeling about with slimy paws when some moving object excites their curiosity. These are the nameless larvae of the other gods, and like them, are blind and without mind, and possessed of singular hungers and thirsts. But that offensive galley did not aim as far as Carter had feared, for he soon saw that the helmsman was steering a course directly for the moon. The moon was a crescent, shining larger and larger as they approached it, and showing its singular craters and peaks uncomfortably. The ship made for the edge, and it soon became clear that its destination was that secret and mysterious side which is always turned away from Earth, and which no fully human person, save perhaps the dreamer Snirith Ko, has ever beheld. The close aspect of the moon as the galley drew near proved very disturbing to Carter, and he did not like the size and shape of the ruins which crumbled here and there. The dead temples on the mountains were so placed that they could have glorified no suitable or wholesome gods. And in the symmetries of the broken columns there seemed to be some dark and inner meaning which did not invite solution. And what the structure and proportions of the olden worshippers could have been, Carter steadily refused to conjecture. When the ship rounded the edge, and sailed over those lands unseen by man, there appeared in the queer landscape certain signs of life, and Carter saw many low, broad, round cottages in fields of grotesque whitish fungi. He noticed that these cottages had no windows, and thought that their shape suggested the huts of the Eskimos. Then he glimpsed the oily waves of a sluggish sea, and knew that the voyage was once more to be by water, or at least through some liquid. The galley struck the surface with a peculiar sound, and the odd elastic way the waves received it was very perplexing to Carter. They now slid along at great speed, once passing and hailing another galley of kindred form, but generally seeing nothing but that curious sea and a sky that was black and star-strewn, even though the sun shone scorchingly in it. There presently rose ahead the jagged hills of a leprous-looking coast, and Carter saw the thick, unpleasant gray towers of a city. The way they leaned and bent, the manner in which they were clustered, and the fact that they had no windows at all, was very disturbing to the prisoner, and he bitterly mourned the folly which had made him sip the curious wine of that merchant with the humped turban. As the coast drew nearer, and the hideous stench of that city grew stronger, he saw upon the jagged hills many forests, some of whose trees he recognized as akin to that solitary moon-tree in the enchanted wood of earth, from whose sap the small brown zugs ferment their curious wine. Carter could now distinguish moving figures on the noisome wharves ahead, and the better he saw them, the worse he began to fear and detest them. For they were not men at all, or even approximately men, but great grayish-white slippery things which could expand and contract at will, and whose principal shape, though it often changed, was that of a sort of toad without any eyes, but with a curious vibrating mass of short pink tentacles on the end of its blunt, vague snout. These objects were waddling busily about the wharves, moving bales and crates and boxes with preternatural strength, and now and then hopping on or off some anchored galley with long oars in their forepaws. And now and then one would appear driving a herd of clumping slaves, which indeed were approximate human beings with wide mouths, like those merchants who traded in Dylath Lean. Only these herds, being without turbans or shoes or clothing, did not seem so very human after all. Some of the slaves, the fatter ones, whom a sort of overseer would pinch experimentally, were unloaded from ships and nailed in crates, which workers pushed into the low warehouses or loaded on great lumbering vans. Once a van was hitched and driven off, and the fabulous thing which drew it was such that Carter gasped, even after having seen the other monstrosities of that hateful place. Now and then, a small herd of slaves dressed in turbans like the dark merchants would be driven aboard a galley, followed by a great crew of the slippery toad things as officers, navigators, and rowers. And Carter saw that the almost human creatures were reserved for the more ignominious kinds of servitude which required no strength, such as steering and cooking, fetching and carrying, and bargaining with men on the earth or other planets where they traded. These creatures must have been convenient on earth, for they were truly not unlike men when dressed and carefully shod and turbaned, and could haggle in the shops of men without embarrassment or curious explanations. But most of them, unless lean or ill-favored, were unclothed and packed in crates and drawn off in lumbering lorries by fabulous things. Occasionally, other beings were unloaded and crated, some very like these semi-humans, some not so similar, and some not similar at all. And he wondered if any of the poor stout black men of Parg were left to be unloaded and crated and shipped inland in those obnoxious drays. When the galley landed at a greasy-looking quay of spongy rock, a nightmare horde of toad-things wiggled out of the hatches, and two of them seized Carter and dragged him ashore. The smell and aspect of that city are beyond telling, and Carter held only scattered images of the tiled streets and black doorways and endless precipices of gray vertical walls without windows. At length he was dragged within a low doorway and made to climb infinite steps in pitch darkness. It was apparently all one to the toad things whether it were light or dark. The odor of the place was intolerable, and when Carter was locked into a chamber and left alone, he scarcely had strength to crawl around and ascertain its form and dimensions. It was circular, and about 20 feet across. From then on, time ceased to exist. At intervals, food was pushed in, but Carter would not touch it. What his fate would be, he did not know. But he felt that he was held for the coming of that frightful soul and messenger of infinity's other gods, the crawling chaos Nyarlathotep. Finally, after an unguessed span of hours or days, the great stone door swung wide again, and Carter was shoved down the stairs and out into the red-lit lights of that fearsome city. It was night on the moon, and all through the town were stationed slaves bearing torches. In a detestable square, a sort of procession was formed. 10 of the toad things and 24 almost human torchbearers, 11 on either side, and one each before and behind. Carter was placed in the middle of the line, 5 toad things ahead and 5 behind, and 1 almost human torchbearer on either side of him. Certain of the toad things produced disgustingly carven flutes of ivory and made loathsome sounds. to that hellish piping, the column advanced out of the tiled streets and into nighted plains of obscene fungi, soon commencing to climb one of the lower and more gradual hills that lay behind the city. That on some frightful slope or blasphemous plateau the crawling chaos waited, Carter could not doubt, and he wished that the suspense might soon be over. The whining of those impious flutes was shocking, and he would have given worlds for some even half-normal sound. But these toad things had no voices, and the slaves did not talk. Then, through that star-specked darkness, there did come a normal sound. It rolled from the higher hills, and from all the jagged peaks around it, was caught up and echoed in a swelling pandemoniac chorus. It was the midnight yell of the cat, and Carter knew at last that the old village folk were right when they made low guesses about the cryptical realms which are known only to cats, and to which the elders among cats repair by stealth nocturnally, springing from high housetops. Verily, it is to the moon's dark side that they go, to leap and gambol on the hills, and converse with ancient shadows. And here, amidst that column of fetid things, Carter heard their homely, friendly cry, and thought of the steep roofs and warm hearths and little white lighted windows of home. Now, much of the speech of cats was known to Randolph Carter, and in this far terrible place he uttered the cry that was suitable. But that he need not have done, for even as his lips opened he heard the chorus wax and draw nearer, and saw swift shadows against the stars as small graceful shapes leaped from hill to hill in gathering legions. The call of the clan had been given, and before the foul procession had time even to be frightened, a cloud of smothering fur and a phalanx of murderous claws were tidally and tempestuously upon it. The flutes stopped, and there were shrieks in the night. Dying almost humans screamed, and cats spit and yowled and roared. But the toad things made never a sound as their stinking green ichor oozed fatally upon that porous earth with the obscene fungi. It was a stupendous sight while the torches lasted, and Carter had never before seen so many cats. Black, gray, and white, yellow, tiger, and mixed, common, Persian, and Manx, Tibetan, Angora, and Egyptian. All were there in the fury of battle, and there hovered over them some trace of that profound and inviolate sanctity which made their goddess great in the temples of Bubastis. They would leap seven strong at the throat of an almost human, or the pink-tentacled snout of a toad thing, and drag it down savagely to the fungus plain, where myriads of their fellows would surge over it and into it with the frenzied claws and teeth of a divine battle-fury. Carter had seized a torch from a stricken slave, but was soon overborne by the surging waves of his loyal defenders. Then he lay in the utter blackness, hearing the clangor of war and the shouts of the victors, and feeling the soft paws of his friends as they rushed to and fro over him in the fray. At last, awe and exhaustion closed his eyes, and when he opened them again, it was upon a strange scene. The great shining disk of the earth, 13 times greater than that of the moon as we see it, had risen with floods of weird light over the lunar landscape, and across all those leagues of wild plateau and ragged crest, there squatted one endless sea of cats in orderly array. Circle on circle they reached, and two or three leaders out of the ranks were licking his face and purring to him consolingly. Of the dead slaves and toad things, There were not many signs. But Carter thought he saw one bone a little way off, in the open space between him and the warriors. Carter now spoke with the leaders in the soft language of cats, and learned that his ancient friendship with the species was well known, and often spoken of in the places where cats congregate. He had not been unmarked in Ulthar when he passed through, and the sleek old cats had remembered how he patted them after they had attended to the hungry Zugs, who looked evilly at a small black kitten. And they recalled, too, how he had welcomed the very little kitten who came to see him at the inn, and how he had given it a saucer of rich cream in the morning before he left. The grandfather of that very little kitten was the leader of the army now assembled, for he had seen the evil procession from a far hill, and recognized the prisoner as a sworn friend of his kind on earth and in the land of dream. A yowl now came from the farther peak, and the old leader paused abruptly in his conversation. It was one of the army's outposts, stationed on the highest of the mountains, to watch the one foe which Earth's cats fear, the very large and peculiar cats from Saturn, who for some reason have not been oblivious of the charm of our moon's dark side. They are leagued by treaty with the evil toad things, and are notoriously hostile to our earthly cats, so that at this juncture a meeting would have been a somewhat grave matter. After a brief consultation of generals, the cats rose and assumed a closer formation, crowding protectingly around Carter, and preparing to take the great leap through space back to the housetops of our earth and its dreamland. The old field marshal advised Carter to let himself be borne along smoothly and passively in the massed ranks of furry leapers, and told him how to spring when the rest sprang, and land gracefully when the rest landed. He also offered to deposit him in any spot he desired, and Carter decided on the city of Dylathleen, whence the black galley had set out, for he wished to sail thence for Oryab and the carven crest Granic, and also to warn the people of the city to have no more traffic with black galleys, if indeed that traffic could be tactfully and judiciously broken off. Then, upon a signal, the cats all leapt gracefully with their friend packed securely in their midst, while in a black cave on an unhallowed summit of the Moon Mountains, still vainly waited the crawling chaos Nyarlathotep. The leap of the cats through space was very swift, and being surrounded by his companions, Carter did not see this time the great black shapelessnesses that lurk and caper and flounder in the abyss. Before he fully realized what had happened, he was back in his familiar room at the inn at Dylathleen, and the stealthy, friendly cats were pouring out of the window in streams. The old leader from Ulthar was the last to leave, and as Carter shook his paw, he said he would be able to get home by cockcrow. When dawn came, Carter went downstairs, and learned that a week had elapsed since his capture and leaving. There was still nearly a fortnight to wait for the ship bound toward Oryab, and during that time he said what he could against the black galleys and their infamous ways. Most of the townsfolk believed him, yet so fond were the jewelers of great rubies that none would wholly promise to cease trafficking with the wide-mouthed merchants. If aught of evil ever befalls Dylathleen through such traffic, it will not be his fault. End of part 2.